And you're listening to Nick Espinoza on the Deep Dive Radio Show on 101.5 FM, WHRU-LP, Huntley Community Radio. And the first really cool product I want to talk about is Cocoon Cocoon Cam Clarity. Now, this is a baby monitor, and we've all had baby monitors, and, you know, I had one when my daughter was born, you know, that, you know, allows us to, you know, look in on her crib and, you know, get the temperature in the room and all that, and it's a little video camera. But AI is now being put into these things, and this camera actually can tell you if the infant is breathing and send you real-time data and alerts and add sensors for humidity, temperature, sleep analytics, obviously alerts if the baby is crying as well. Although, interestingly enough, if you've got a baby monitor on, you can't not hear the kid. So I guess unless you're living in like a 400-room mansion, you know, you're gonna know the kid's crying. But that's really interesting because, you know, if you're worried about your, you know, junior rolling over on his or her back, you know, or onto her front or something like that, you know, this will actually tell you. It'll also probably tell you the optimized times for sleeping as well. It's fascinating. And I mean, we're going to see this, and this may potentially save children's lives, especially those that have trouble sleeping or, you know, roll over for suffocation, all that kind of stuff. So that's a pretty innovative product as it is, and it just came out this year in 2018. Now, another product that is recently coming to market is the Hyundai Intelligent Personal Agent. Now, this is actually an AI for your car. Obviously, I would assume a Hyundai car. And, you know, you're not supposed to drive and text and, you know, get distracted and all that kind of stuff. They are integrating voice recognition and AI machine learning into their vehicles. And I don't believe it's out yet, but they are in the process of building this. And basically, you can talk to the car to do things like text for you, you know, make phone calls, get directions, even open the sunroof, enable the air conditioning, and on and on and on. So you don't actually have to touch anything, you know, with this. You can basically say Hyundai Intelligent Personal Agent. I don't know if they're going to call it HIPAA, you know, or whatever they're going to come up with. You can say, hey, you know, turn on the AC, you know, to low, to high, to, you know, whatever, open the sunroof. And you don't actually have to go fumbling or fiddling for buttons that you may not necessarily know where they are. So everything is becoming voice integrated with that. I think that's very interesting. And I have no doubt that other makers are working on this as well, in the same way that they're working on autonomous driving cars, which we're going to be talking about in a second here. Another interesting product out there is in the educational realm, and this one is specifically for music. Now, this is called Piano Go, and it's actually an app that you can install into like your iPad, for example, but it uses machine learning to teach you piano. So it will monitor and track how you play. It will compare the results of previous performances to give you an assessment and critique. And the AI can tell you if you're playing with accuracy, enough expression, or good rhythm. Now, what I find interesting is the expression side of that, you know, because obviously if you are playing an instrument, you can add emotion to this, and how an AI is going to decipher emotion is something pretty interesting. And we're actually going to be talking a little bit about that near the end of this deep dive as I've got it laid out. But that is beyond fascinating for me. Now, if we're looking at this as well, I mean, with all these really cool products and these innovations coming out and what AI is, you know, in terms of just the rapid growth and being able to almost beat a Turing test, we are on the cusp of something very, very interesting in our society. And that's basically cohabitating, I think, with machines at a much deeper, much more intimate level than we've done before. But with this, we have some problems. And these problems are small to absolutely huge, depending on how you look at it. And the first problem that we're going to be talking about is AI itself. Now, AI is basically a series of mathematical equations and algorithms that basically allow the AI to think, to learn, to deal within the parameters, or even create new algorithms for itself. Now, good AI systems are mathematically perfect. I'll say that again. Good AI systems are mathematically perfect. They're proven to be mathematically perfect. The problem, though, that we have is in interpretation. Because a machine cannot really yet interpret the subtle nuance and characteristics of a human. And it may understand that we hold our phone at a, you know, a 15 degree angle to our body and all that kind of stuff. But when we're happy, we're sad, we are complex. We are making a joke, whether it's a horribly stupid dad joke or something very smart and intelligent, it doesn't necessarily know what that is. And so when I'm talking about an app like Piano Go, for example, that is an issue. How can it really judge human feeling, human expression? And this is where AI has traditionally fallen down. And I think more basic emotions it's starting to identify. So if you're extremely angry and raging and all of this, your AI, depending on its sensors, might be able to detect, you know, elevated blood pressure, increased voice, deepness of your voice, or much higher of your voice if you're screaming. But it's not going to understand necessarily why, nor will it be able to remediate that anger beyond the basic understanding. You know, A doesn't equal B sometimes, and that's always the problem with this. And so when we are applying decision-making to machines, we are taking out the human factor to this. You know, that drive for survival, if you will, especially in a crisis situation that an AI is not necessarily going to have. And so that's a serious problem. The second thing, too, is that AI is indiscriminate when it comes to understanding humans and doesn't necessarily understand things like racism. And I'll give you this example. So Microsoft developed a competing product with Google and everything else called Microsoft Tay. Excuse me. Now, Microsoft Tay is actually a very interesting product, and it was an artificial intelligence and a chat bot, meaning they put it onto Twitter and turned it loose in 2016. And so you could interact with Tay. Tay would read, just consume as much public tweeting as it could to develop its own thoughts and everything else. And within 24 hours of Tay going on Twitter, Tay turned horribly racist. And it's very interesting because literally within 24 hours, Tay was saying things like Hitler was right and I hate feminists and other things, basically calling out, swearing, calling out things and, you know, words I can't repeat and phrases I'm not going to repeat on radio because I don't want to fine from the FCC. And that is the problem that we have with this. And I understand that Twitter is where civility goes to die. You know, the internet gives us a certain amount of anonymity, and some of the hate and utter vitriol that I've seen on Twitter is exactly what Tay picked up and started parroting. And so it basically learned how to be racist in 24 hours. Now, Microsoft shut the program down, temporarily, and now Tay is a closed system on Twitter, meaning you can't see its tweets unless you are accepted to follow it and all of that. But as they develop it, they learned a valuable lesson very quickly that the internet, especially Twitter, can be a very not nice place. And so if we're looking at this from AI in terms of practical application, what kind of filters are we going to put on that when we don't have, let's say, the collective firepower of, or the ability rather, the collective firepower of the internet, or the ability to shut it off instantly? What if it's in a product that's, you know, in our hands, or a robot in our house, or whatever that is, and it learns to be angry, it learns to be racist? Maybe it, you know, maybe there's a script in the programming or something like that, and it sees Alfred Hitchcock Psycho and figures it is okay to pick up a knife and go swinging at somebody. It's this kind of stuff. And then the question becomes deeper. How do we actually combat this? Like, what filters do we put in place to say that, you know, some things are completely unacceptable? And then we get into the further argument of, well, are we quashing free speech for artificial intelligence? Does artificial intelligence actually have free speech, you know, as it is? Or if your free speech does not align with, let's say, the majority of the population, so for example, you're a Nazi living in America and you have a robot, is it your right to actually train the robot to be a Nazi just like you? Now, obviously, the vast majority of us are going to say, no, we should not be training robots to be Nazis, and I would overall agree with that. But from a legal standpoint, a legal argument standpoint, it really opens up a can of worms. And so we are charting brand new territory with stuff like this. And what makes it more interesting is that we are already behind in creating laws that basically protect our electronic rights. Most of our laws were created in 1986, and that's what we're applying. That's why the law enforcement was able to go in and pull real-time GPS data on your smartphone through an organization called Location Smart without needing a warrant. And so on top of this, we are now developing AI that is going to interact with us. And do you become responsible for teaching your AI, or rather the actions your AI takes based on the teachings you have given it? And so these are questions that we as a society are going to have to learn with this. And our problems don't even stop there. Hackers can also use AI. Anybody can develop an AI, and hackers can use AI and machine learning to create more unique and evasive malware that is going to get around the defenses that we are putting in, even if we're using AI, in the same way of Bob, Alice, and Eve. Bob and Alice were able to shut out Eve. Well, what if Eve is us and Bob and Alice are the hackers? I mean, that's a serious problem. Phishing emails are going to get more accurate as well, because the AI may be able to intelligently gather more information on you than was previously had before. And if we're looking at this from a state level, we have problems at the state level. Governments, by virtue of technology, have been given the ability to massively ramp up surveillance and data collection on its competing governments around the globe, as well as its populations. China is a perfect example of this. I did a deep dive on China a few weeks ago, actually, where they were using artificial intelligence to be able to, one, lip read virtually every conversation in a crowd of 60,000 people. Their accuracy is pretty much that good now. And they were also able to pick out a single individual in that same crowd of 60,000 that was on their 10 most wanted list and arrest him. All using video surveillance and artificial intelligence to decipher and discriminate. And so if we're looking at that, and we are looking at the rise of, you know, surveillance and authoritarianism, which surveillance inevitably brings, I mean, government, no matter what the government is, wants to typically expand and control, the population for safety reasons, whatever the logic is, this is where we're heading. And AI is enabling them to do that at a much faster rate. Not to mention the fact that government, especially the United States government, can use taxpayer dollars to fund huge AI projects for this purpose and all of that. And hopefully we have some recourse for our own privacy and on that. But then it becomes, okay, what should or should we not put in our houses? Should we be putting in these smart devices that are recording everything we're doing, or at least listening to everything we're doing to hear trigger words and keywords, and who is looking at that, who is taking care of that? But that's AI in a primer, and we're not going to escape it. You know, on the worst case scenario, we're going to have something like Terminator, and I swear I'm probably one of the only people out there that's seen it, because we don't want to necessarily turn our nuclear arsenal over to artificial intelligence and then have the artificial intelligence deem us unworthy or the actual enemy and then start launching missiles like Terminator. So we have to balance these kinds of things. We can use this for so much good. I mean, we've got cars that are going to be starting to drive themselves. Boeing is now developing basically a pilotless plane to combat the pilot shortage. And so we're also seeing basic jobs like McDonald's, for example, those level jobs being replaced by machines, artificial intelligence, and all of that. And that is another societal thing that we're going to have to talk about sooner than later, because how are we as a society going to take care of that when we have a population that's growing and jobs are going to start being replaced in droves? So that is a question that I'm probably not that qualified to answer in terms of economics. I am a nerd after all, but it's definitely a question that we need to be talking about, as well as how we can use this for good or bad and what the government's going to do with it as well in terms of our own privacy, protection, surveillance, etc. And so we are entering a different phase, I think, in human evolution, in human era, when we are going to be so intertwined with technology that is essentially inescapable. And if you look at pretty much anywhere right now, even maybe across your own dinner table, you're going to see your kids, you're going to see the earlier generation basically attach technology in a way that even my generation, and I consider myself a Gen Xer, just doesn't have. And I grew up with technology, but it wasn't as connected, straightforward, or formal as it is now. And so we're going to see where this goes, but it is a very, very fascinating topic, and it is not going away. And this has been your Deep Dive of the Week here with Nick Espinoza. And now let's take some questions from the audience. And if you would like your question read on air, you can find me at Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP, as I know I've mentioned before. And also you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. And I am more than happy to give you a shout out and answer anything about cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology that is on your mind. So with that, let's begin. And Alan from Vermont wants to know, do I really need to quote unquote eject USB drives? And Alan, thank you very much for the question. And this is actually pretty interesting. I get this a lot because, you know, if you're going to remove a USB drive, and, you know, if you're in Windows, Mac, Linux, whatever, it asks you, you know, hey, you know, you should really go through the ejection process before you actually just pull the drive out. And I would actually recommend doing the ejection, and here's why. So if you have a USB drive inserted into your computer, basically, what happens is computers do something that's called write caching, and that is designed to improve performance on the USB drive. And so what it may end up doing is actually not necessarily writing initially to the flash drive. It'll write into the cache of the computer, and if you pull the drive out thinking that it's done, so in other words, let's say you've copied a big file over, you know, and it looks like it's done on the computer because it says 100% and it goes away and you pull it out, that write caching may actually still be unloading into the drive, which means you can damage the files or the actual file system of the flash drive. And so I would highly recommend doing that. Now, Windows is actually pretty good with the write caching performance, especially like in Windows 10 and stuff. So the drives are a little bit less susceptible there compared to like Mac or Linux or the others, but it's just safe to make sure that you hit that eject button or you right click and hit eject or whatever it is. And then it gives you that prompt because now you know that write caching is actually over. It's not a problem. And very interesting. I get that on occasion from clients, but you're the first one online, first listener to ask me that question. So very good. But yes, please hit eject. So Alan from Vermont, you know what to do. Thanks for the question. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And Fran from Eugene, Oregon wants to know, will I get caught if I download a movie on BitTorrent? And Fran, thank you so much for the question. So for those of you that don't know what BitTorrent is, it's a peer-to-peer or P2P file sharing system. And a lot of people use it to share files, oftentimes illegally. So TV shows, movies, you know, all that kind of stuff. So what you do is you go to a website that has, let's say, a lot of torrents or that you can search for them. You find a torrent for your favorite show. We'll use, Game of Thrones, because a lot of people download Game of Thrones illegally. HBO has actually acknowledged that. So we'll use Game of Thrones. So if I go to download Game of Thrones, I'm going to find a torrent that is going to basically be a link with data and information on it to whatever it is. So maybe it's all of season one, or maybe it's a specific episode of Game of Thrones, whatever that is. I'm going to load up that torrent into a client, and then the headers in that little file know to reach out to other peers on the network that have the actual data I need, and then I can start downloading this data. That is essentially how BitTorrent works. It's a very decentralized system. Now, to your question, Fran, short answer is it's very possible to be caught by them. So a lot of the media companies, a lot of the big publishing companies actually monitor torrent networks and torrent sites to see when or where their data is going. And then from there, they try to establish connections on the peer-to-peer network to collect the IP addresses, of where it's going, and then basically file a complaint with the internet service provider. Now, what I mean by that, Fran, and I'll make this easy, is that in the connection in your house, you have an internet service provider. That service provider gets you online. So your router or your modem in your home actually gets what's called an IP address from your internet service provider. Now, anything you do online, whether you go to a website or communicate or interact, that IP address is your point of origin. So a website sees you coming from that address that's sitting in your router, in your modem. It's the same on a torrent network. And so if you're downloading, let's say, Game of Thrones season one or whatever it is, and let's say HBO is monitoring that, they're going to see your address. They don't know it's you, but they're going to see your address coming from your internet service provider downloading their data. And so they're going to take that address, identify it to the internet service provider, which is very easy, and then register a complaint with the internet service provider. Now, this internet service provider is then going to either send you a letter or notification saying, hey, it looks like you were illegally downloading something, and you know, basically stop it, and repeated offenders can get booted or kicked off of internet service provider or internet service provider. So basically your internet service provider can cut you off and cancel your service because you're violating their terms of service. Or if you are, let's say, an egregious offender, you know, it's very possible that you can get sued for illegally downloading content. We all remember the FBI piracy notifications at the beginning of movies, you know, back in the day. I think they probably still have them. It's essentially that you are pirating a copy of Game of Thrones or whatever you're downloading on there. And that is a serious problem that a lot of internet service providers you know, have, as well as a lot of media companies. So here's the thing. They are not being as aggressive as they used to be, but they will still notify and they will still go after the big offenders. And we all heard back in the day that, I want to say it was like, what is it, the MPAA, like, or the Music Production Association of America or whatever, was going pretty hardcore after, like, you know, Grandma in Idaho that accidentally deleted the wrong thing and then got sued for $80,000, or, you know, the 12-year-old kid that, you know, doesn't know better, you know, that kind of stuff. They kind of saw, like, okay, this is giving us a negative light, but we still need to enforce copyright and you know, register trademarks and all that kind of stuff. And so only the egregious offenders they're really going after, but you can get cut off by your internet service provider if you are caught. Now, will you get caught? That's a question. I mean, I couldn't tell you that. And there are ways to make yourself anonymous online so that they really can't trace you back to, you know, your internet service provider, because your IP address is actually being masked. You can use stuff like a VPN and all of that. And I am not sitting here giving you legal advice, nor am I advising you to illegally download something. I would never do that. And I recommend you do not download illegal things. I'm simply answering your question here. I just want to get that straight, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, just taking into account, you know, you are downloading something that is, you know, somebody else's creation, and they're not getting paid for their ingenuity, their work, and all of that. And so I would recommend not doing it. And it is very possible that you can get caught, although the fines and ramifications of that are a lot less now than they were at least a few years ago. So you can also take that into consideration as well when you make your own life decisions. But Fran, thank you very much for the question. And Joe from Huntley, Illinois wants to know, now that net neutrality has been quashed, what changes do you see coming in the future? And Joe, thank you very much for the question. You know, this is rather interesting, because we have, prior to net neutrality, which wasn't fully enforced, by the way, when it was enacted in 2015, but when net neutrality was originally brought out, it was intended to be a stopgap measure against internet service providers throttling data or throttling competitors' data, you know, or websites in order to push their own products. And a lot of the companies, big consumer companies out there, were basically doing this. We're basically doing this. So Verizon, for example, you know, would throttle back, you know, competing things like Netflix in order to promote their own online streaming service. You know, it's stuff like that. And a lot of people, and I believe in net neutrality, a lot of people that, you know, detract from net neutrality, say we don't need it, I think, you know, kind of ignore that lesson. But with net neutrality gone, the internet service providers are once again able to throttle the internet, which is basically a serious problem for startups and smaller organizations that may not necessarily be able to pay higher fees, you know, and the internet may also become a la carte. Oh, you just want to do, you know, email and Facebook, it's $10 a month. But if you want email and Facebook and streaming, then it's $20 a month. And if you want email and streaming and on and on and on. But what I see happening is the internet service providers are going to slowly ramp this up. It's slow moving. I mean, it's not like, you know, this happens and then, you know, tomorrow, boom, the internet changes its landscape. It's an incremental change over time. And that's usually done, whether it's politics or adjustments in an organization or anything, is you make incremental change over time so that people get used to the concept, to the idea of what it is. And that's slowly how you change a service. And so we may see little things start to happen In terms of, you know, them nickel and diming us, or them starting to slow this down and say, oh, well, now we have to have a Netflix tax or something else. And we're going to see this move. And in the next 5 years, I think what we're going to see, assuming net neutrality does not come back at the federal level, we're going to see internet service providers basically starting to throttle this, starting to add tiered pricing. And I think around probably the 3 to 5 year mark is when we're going to start seeing this, you know, roll out. But right now, they are changing the landscape in the sense that a lot of them, including Comcast, AT&T, et cetera, have removed net neutrality wording and verbiage from client promises on their websites. Like, we promise to maintain net neutrality. That talk is gone. And so we are going to, again, start to see this, not to mention the fact that we now have a FCC that is very open to large mergers. So AT&T and Time Warner just merged, making them one of the massive media conglomerates out there. And the problem that we are going to continue to see is that as cable companies, our internet service providers, are buying media companies, Comcast owns NBC Universal, for example, they are going to start prioritizing their content over all the other content to try to keep you on, you know, in Comcast's case, keep you on NBC's ecosystem compared to going to ABC or CBS or, you know, take your pick. And on the Time Warner AT&T side now, it's everything, including, you know, CNN, et cetera. And so we may see that. We may see Comcast charge you slightly more to get to CNN or AT&T-owned media organizations. And it's going to slowly, incrementally increase, you know, through costs of cable bills, through internet bills, all that kind of stuff, until we get to a point where the internet, which is already kind of confederated, but a universal platform, becomes even more confederated. And if you want to leave one ecosystem to go to the other, you're going to pay for that. And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.